to the 9 o'clock session. I'm a little nervous today because I'm actually the summit coordinator, and this is always the fun time when it begins the summit. But we don't usually introduce our ACU. We don't usually introduce our ACU people, but I know Arlene very well, and I couldn't resist but to introduce her today. It's my privilege and honor. I think I have known Arlene longer than David has known Arlene. That's a long time. Because I think you all got married when Arlene was 5 and David was 7. Okay, she was 18 or 19 and he was a little older. We have grown up together in South Africa. Arlene's mom and my mom were best friends. So Arlene and David are really, and Michaela and Spencer are like family, more than just friends. I think one of the things I love about Arlene the most is that she is a true disciple of Jesus. She has walked alongside me in the valleys and in the blessings in life, and it is a true blessing to have a friend like Arlene. Today, the topic that she's going to be talking about, I don't think I can think of anybody more qualified to talk about truth on our story from South Africa and what it was like growing up as a white South African during the years of apartheid. And also as a Christian, there were some issues we had to work through. Good morning. So please help me welcome Arlene. And I'm going to hang around for a while, and then I'm going to duck out the door.
Okay. Anyone else need to get seated first? Thank you, Mandy.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a weird day for me. Primarily because my family has been mocking me more than usual about my accent over the last few days. And now whenever I hear it aloud in the room, it feels worse. So for the... Well, thank you. For those of you that have not heard me before, I always usually start off not doing the I'm going to apologize first thing, but doing the thing that says, if you don't understand something, wave and I will repeat it. Because what I've managed to do, and I'm admitting this in front of one of my old English teachers, what I've managed to do is retain the flat intonation of a South African and elongate the vowels like a West Texan. And so it's really the worst of both accents combined. So if there's something you don't get, just flag me down. I have known Mandy for, I was working it out today, I think 8 years.
You know our age.
And
you're older than me.
It has been a sweet, sweet friendship. It's really, it's awesome to talk about a topic like this with my own family in the room and my best buddy over there, and Meryl. And I feel I need to say this, because occasionally you hear people use the expression, well, I ran into a friend, or I bumped into a friend. And I can honestly say that I was in Walmart on 351 a couple of years ago, and I was at the cheese and deli meat section where the cream cheese is. And I've got my little buggy, and I'm doing my little shopping thing. And I see this person, and I think, wow, that looks like Meryl, this girl that I knew in South Africa. Because everybody knew Meryl. Her dad was like a rock star preacher, and everybody knew them. Mm-hmm. And I walked it further, and I thought, that looks more than just like Meryl. That really looks like Meryl. And so I turned around, and we looked at each other, and then we started this conversation, and it really was her. We bumped into each other at Walmart, and we live in the same town, and I've known her as long as I can remember church experiences, really. So yeah, this is a weird thing to be talking about your story from home and have actual people sitting in the audience who shared that story with you. Really, really sweet. I want to acknowledge two things. First of all, I do not set myself up as any kind of expert on American race relations. I don't. I'm not American by birth. And I have a birth certificate to prove it. Not American by birth. I am a citizen. I'm a legal citizen. Everybody breathe. But I don't set myself up as an expert on the historical story of America. What I do know is I know what I've lived in South Africa. And I know where the place of residence would be with you. And some of, like with any good metaphor, it's great in the beginning and then at some point it breaks down. That would be true of my experiences in South Africa. Some of them really apply and you'll find places of connection, and then some of them you're going to go, yeah, maybe, maybe not. So please don't hear this as me giving some great advice about how America needs to do life, because that's not what I'm thinking or what my intention is. But just to give you some stories. I'll start out by saying I was born in 1967.
which was right in the middle of probably the hotbed period of apartheid in South Africa. Nelson Mandela had been in prison about 3 or 4 years, and I was born into a culture and into an environment that said the terrorist who attacked our country and was instrumental in the orchestration of other attacks is behind bars. At the same time, another narrative was at play in the larger world that said Free Mandela. And you may remember those, the T-shirts and the posters and the hats. So I'm living an experience that goes, the person's in prison that is responsible for much of this, and then the rest of the world is saying, we need to do everything we can to free this man. And so you might remember the world sanctions that happened. Okay, if we just squeeze and we press South Africa, they'll make some changes. Hey, Jana. And so there was kind of this interesting tension at play where we're living in this thing where white South Africans are saying, okay, behind bars, and so are some of his accomplices, this is a good thing, and the rest of the world is saying, we got to do something to make them release him. So I grew up in that environment, but 1972, it's time for me to go to school, and my parents choose to send me to a private girls-only school. And I told the theater students the other day, think Hogwarts without the spells, because that's essentially, that was the experience. It was like, yeah, I go to this private girls' school, and they made that choice for several reasons, but one of the real fundamental reasons was, unlike American private education at the time, which was used, I think, as a bastion of whiteness, where people could, you know, go and live their separate experience, in South Africa, it was a place where government control could not reach. So a private school could do things that other schools were not doing. So I had racially integrated schooling from the get-go, which doesn't seem like a big deal to you, but it was a big deal. It was a big deal in South Africa, because the rest of the country, I don't think, experienced that until like 90, maybe 1990. So it's 1972, and I go to school, and I meet these little friends, and they're just like me. And to use Don McLaughlin's phrase, they just wrapped in a different skin color. But these people are just like me. And I start hearing stories that I've never heard before. And these students, it was a boarding school primarily. There were a handful of us that didn't stay in the dormitory, that we were day students, but it's primarily a boarding school. And I heard stories of students just like me whose parents were living in Liberia or in Kenya or in Belgium or in England because their parents were in exile. And I had no context to even understand, like, why? What does this mean? Well, somebody's dad was a political activist, or somebody else's dad was high in the Anglican Church, which at that point, a lot of clergy were forcing political issues in South Africa, and you know Bishop Desmond Tutu, and behind him is a stream of other clergy people who were doing the same thing. So I'm meeting kids whose parents are living overseas because they can't live in South Africa. And in the innocence of a child who's been protected from some of that news, and also out of sheer ignorance, I ask, why? Why can't your parents be here? Because these kids seem just like me, so surely their parents are. And then I start hearing stories about, well, do you know what it's like to be black in this country? Well, clearly I don't. I live in a white-only neighborhood with white-only friends, and I go to restaurants that are white-only restaurants, and I have no idea. And our media is so heavily censored, and there's so much propaganda that I'm only getting a portion of the story. And so part of the government that is upholding this political system and regime is also governing most of the media outlets. But you're unaware of that when you're in it. And so I start hearing the stories about, do you know that there's a curfew at the end of the day when I have to have left the city area? Oh, I didn't know that. Do you know that I have to be registered and that I have to have papers to prove my identity? Well, no, I didn't know that. Do you know that there's such systemic issues in our family systems that families are breaking down ridiculously? Well, no, I'm not. Why would that be happening? Oh, that's because our dads are leaving home and going to work wherever they can get work, and then going back home every couple months, and that our mothers are your maids. And I had a maid. I grew up with somebody who worked in my house and lived on my property.
in a room attached to my home.
Had it occurred to me ever that that was not a great thing? No. That's all I knew. And so this woman who worked for me, her name was Miriam,
she loved me like her own. And I had no context except just think, this is a beautiful, wonderful human who loves me. And now when I think about the fact that I was the child in her life because her own children were at home, it reframes that. And I'm thinking, how were you both gracious and kind and nurturing and still able to serve us? So I start hearing these stories from kids just like me. And we go on field trips, lots of field trips, because it's a boarding school. If it wasn't for the school taking you places, you didn't really get to do things. And the few of us that were day students would go with. And I had my first couple of experiences of going to a restaurant and them saying, nope, if Pumala's in the group, you don't get to go. And you're 10 or 11, and that starts to form you. And what happens, I think for some people it's profound sadness, and for some people it's like, And then for people that are already bent a certain way, it lights a fire in you. Do you want to guess where on the spectrum? But I start hearing the stories of injustice, and I start seeing my friends denied basic rights, and this whole thing just is no longer working for my little brain. So that's the story of going to school. I want to kind of push the pause button there and tell you a story alongside this that kind of runs parallel. Michaela just heard this, and I think she was part mortified, part amused. And your theater students may need some decompressing, Donna. But when I was about 5 or 6, I decided I wanted to be a journalist. And I've always had plenty words, all the words. And I realized pretty quickly, even as a thanks, Anne, even as a little kid, I could see a human angle on almost anything that happened. There was an angle that I could see. So I decided, like all 5, 6, 7-year-olds do, that I would make a newspaper. And I didn't have access to a computer or a photocopy machine, so I hand wrote a newspaper, multiple copies of the newspaper. And I cut out pictures and stuck it on the publication and stapled it and delivered it. And people kept accepting them, which is the most important. And so in doing that, I became like this neighborhood sleuth child. It was the combination of my two greatest things. I got to be Nancy Drew meets reporter. And I crept the neighborhood. Basically, because I wrote stories about what was happening in the neighborhood. And now the picture of the 8-year-old kind of stalking out the neighborhood is just highly amusing to me. But it's what I did. And I told the theater kids the other day, it gave me great skills because I'm the best social media stalker ever. It's like, I honed that thing, man. But something struck a passion there because my heart had been moved by what I was seeing around me, and I had this urge to tell a story and have people tell their stories. So I was going to be a journalist. And I went all the way through high school, I'm going to be a journalist. And my dad died when I was 12. And things changed between my mom and I. You know, the relationship changed. It was just the two of us. And we figured a new way. But by the time I got to graduation, 17 and a half, my mom said, no, you're not going to be a journalist. And she just never parented that way. I was like, what do you mean? This is my whole life, I've waited for this. And she went, no, you're going to go to prison. Which was what I wanted, because real people who, you know, were into the cause would go to prison for it. Yes, I'm going to go to prison. Yes, I am. Watch me. And she was like, no, you're not going to be a journalist. Crushed me, because that's what I'd spent my whole life working toward. And so I said, put a pause on the actual life unfolding story there, because this was another narrative that's at play. Arlene has got this passion that's working for her, and she's going to tell these stories somehow. And then, of course, I don't get to do that, and I'm reeling because I don't know what else I want to do. And through a weird set of circumstances, I got offered a job at Barclays Bank, which I really shouldn't have had at the time. I didn't have a degree, and it was a weird thing, but I landed up taking a job that would lead me other great places. But all that to say, you
you couldn't have had the school experience I had when your friends weren't having the same experience and not be moved to want to do something. Okay, so pause that story and we're going to go back into the unfolding of the life. So this is my life story through about 12. And this passion is ignited, and then my dad dies. And he'd been in the hospital for 2 weeks, and it was really sudden. It wasn't a long illness. And, man, nothing recalculates your experience quite like that as quickly. And we come to find out that his business partner, he was an entertainer by night. I'll explain. I do have pictures of my dad in drag framed at my house. But anyway, he was a musician and an actor and stand-up comedian guy, and that's kind of what we did. But then he had these odd businesses to sort of pay the bills in between. And one of his business partners, who he was in one of these like odd daytime businesses with, had embezzled the business and moved to Europe and landed up with my mom and I having to sell our home and move into a flat and start life again, essentially. And when we did that, she took a job, first time she'd ever worked, and she took a job with the Natal School of Preaching, which was a rural preacher training school that trained black preachers in South Africa. I'm jumping around. I'm sorry. David, listen to this. Can we find the picture of Samson and Jerome? Okay. we start a new life. And my mom is this missionary care person for all these rural preachers. And so what happens is that they start coming into the city once a month to get what they need, supplies and financial transfers and everything, and they come to our flat. And so I start meeting all these amazing young and older black preachers. And these two men, Samson and Jerome, they start stepping in to that gap that was lost when my dad died. And I don't know if they knew they were doing that. Maybe they did. But started speaking into my life and shaping me and checking in with me and just being those father figures that I didn't have. And they would come over, and like any good South African kid, and you can both say amen to this, the minute a guest like went like this in your house, the tea kettle went on. Okay. And so the role of the South African child would be, you go put the kettle on, you kind of set the tea tray, you make the tea and bring it out. Your parents would never have gotten up and made tea if there was a child in the room. That was your job. Anyway, they're saying we're not South African by birth, just by acculturation. So Samson, Jerome, all these other preachers would come over once a month, and I would go make the tea, bring it in, put it down. It was only once I had friends over that did I realize they were looking at me really strangely, because I, as the white child, was serving the black guests. Okay, two things. Most kids my age were not having regular black visitors at their houses, and they certainly wouldn't have been serving them. But I didn't know any different, because that's how we lived. It's what my mother did and expected. And slowly but surely, I start having great conversations with these, especially these two. And they start guiding and correcting and speaking into my life. And Samson comes to me one day and he says, I want you to read this book. Puts a book in my hand. And it was a book that you probably are familiar with called Black Like Me, big in the 70s, banned in South Africa. Don't know how he got a copy. Never thought to ask. still don't think my mother knew he gave it to me. But he said, I want you to read this and let's talk about it. So I read this book and I was mortified. Here was a real life experience for somebody. And I'm reading this and I'm resonating because I'm seeing, you know what? I've seen a child have this experience. I know, at least I've observed it. I don't know what it's like, but I've observed it. And we start processing that. And I come to find out that there's a little bit of political activism happening with both of these two that's kept kind of on the down low from church because that wasn't the kind of church environment. But they just start educating me and talking to me about the reality of what is it like when you can be arrested for no real crime and you can be beaten for being in the wrong place. And if it wasn't for the white missionaries that traveled with them at certain times, their lives would be just hell on earth. And so just more education is coming at me, more real experience from people I'm living alongside. This picture, I'll just break and tell you, is from this summer when my family got to go to South Africa and meet them. David obviously knew them. Samson, the one who looks like Sidney Poitier, beautiful man. He was the preacher at the Edendale Church of Christ, and Jerome next to him was the troublemaker. You can see it on his face. Wonderful guy. But they worked at a church about 30 minutes from where we lived in a black township, and my mom would take me to church there often. And we'd drive out there, and we'd be the only white people. Sometimes there'd be an official, like, mixing type thing, and our church would go out, but we went to church there a lot. And these people became my friends and my guiding places. And so I wanted to share that with you, just more for me than for you, really. But so that's how that story starts to unfold. Well, I moved through high school, and life shifts and changes. I'm starting to work in the travel business. In 1990, I find myself in Austria, and I'm on a bus. I go to Zurich, and I'm about to fly from Zurich back to South Africa. And I'm in the airport in Zurich, and I look up at the TV screens, and this thing flashes across the screen that says, Nelson Mandela released from prison. And I'm in Europe. And for the average citizen, we had no preparation. We didn't know this was happening. What was happening is, for 6-8 months before that, they had actually been bringing Nelson Mandela from the kind of temporary housing situation he was in to the mainland of Cape Town, and they were negotiating, and there were government negotiations happening, but the average citizen didn't know that. And that, again, goes to how media was played, but I think it was probably one of the smarter moves in South Africa's history, that wasn't common knowledge at the time. Negotiations are made, and he is released from prison. And I don't know if there's a way for any of you to understand the kind of tension and fear mixed with hope that floods a country. Because you've got a generation of people that have been told, the terrorist responsible for this, this, and this, and this is in prison. Now he's being released after 27 years. And his wife, at the time, part crazy. I don't know what the other part is. had done a really good job of keeping his name at the forefront of everything for years and years and years. So Winnie Mandela had fought this fight to free Nelson Mandela and to keep a groundswell of activism happening in South Africa, and he is released. And your average white South African is thinking, this is the end of life as I know it. There is about to be a civil war in this country. It's payback time. It's retaliation. And bearing in mind, you've got a population where more than 80% are non-white. So this one man, one vote thing that has been heralded by the rest of the world has terrified white South Africans. Because you know, the simple math means there's going to be a shift of epic proportion. And so fear is rampant. And white South Africans start leaving South Africa in their droves. And so Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and England just start getting huge populations of white South Africans who are fearful. They're afraid of what's going to happen economically, so they take their money with them. Talk about causing instability. You have this sort of white flight that happens in fear, and the economy is rocked, and there's a sense of uncertainty, huge change coming. And so that begins to take place. But you guys already know this part of the story because you lived it with us. Nelson Mandela is released from prison. And there's a lot of yelling and screaming. But he lands up not being radical enough for the radicals and being too radical for some of the establishment. But he starts to walk this line, this very fine line, and holds intention. I've got to bring this lot of people along with me, and I've got to keep this lot of people calm, because if I don't, there is going to be a civil war in this country. And so that is the start of a shift in South Africa that many of us, we moved to America in 91, and Mandy followed 94. Many of us who were at ACU during that time got in cars and drove to Dallas to the embassy and voted in 1994. And it was the first time
David and I voted. We weren't prepared to vote in elections before because we weren't going to uphold what was happening. But this was the first time we got to stand in line with other South Africans that were living abroad and vote. And we voted for Nelson Mandela. And I was like, what happened in my life from here?
You know, and there's the old saying about terrorist or freedom fighter. It depends on which side of the battle you're on, you know? So what a huge shift in just a short span of years.
So that takes us to a place where we move from South Africa to come to college, and then we watch the rest of the shift from a distance. And that's a weird thing. It's weird to see your flag change. It's weird to see your national anthem go from the song that was banned because it was the song of the Communist Party to your national anthem. And it's weird to see names of cities change. Some of the places you were born in, the names changed. Airport names changed, and they became the names of people who were standout people during the freedom fight struggle, people that we associated with terrorism. Oliver Tambo and Steve Biko and all these people that there's so much history around, that we had heard one side of the story, and all of a sudden this was the new story of our country. Very strange to observe that from a distance. But in about 1994, Bishop Tutu, who, really interesting character. If you've never spent no time with Bishop Tutu, just get on YouTube and just Google some things. Fascinating man. Smart, quirky, weird, funny. But a man of the cloth. And he spurred South Africa to things that I don't think would have happened the way they happened without him. And he walked alongside Nelson Mandela. And a lot of what we credit Nelson Mandela to, I think, only happened because Desmond Tutu was right there with him, forming some things. And they form what is called the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. And some of you may have heard about this. Not a war tribunal, not that. But an organization of justice that moved around the country, that went from town to town, and they had attorneys and police officers and victims and perpetrators all sitting in rooms, and people got to tell their story and say, this is the story of oppression for me. You are the policeman who killed my child. And then a policeman's family being able to say, you are the person who set my home on fire. And there was this telling of truth of, these are the ways you hurt me. These are the things that happened. This is what's not okay. Mothers crying and falling on the floor, just devastated because they'd lost children. But a time for telling the truth. And there was forgiveness extended. It really was never set up to be a let me try you and put you in prison kind of event. It was a let's tell our stories, which resonates with what we're doing today. Tell me your story. And so the Truth and Reconciliation Committee keeps going around the country and forming and changing, and there's forgiveness and there's devastation. And it was hard, and most hard things are also good like that. And amazing things were accomplished. But one of the things that I think most of us had to say about 1993 or 4, you had to ask yourselves two questions. Am I a racist? And I think that's a foundational question. Because people my age in South Africa had to ask the question of themselves and be honest. I don't think people of my age in America have ever had to ask that question and be honest. Because I think you guys assume you're not. And there's a big difference there. We were legally racists. It was our government system. And then you saw it play out even in the best intentions. So we had to say to ourselves, am I a racist, and what does that look like for me? And how am I going to live under this new government system? I think my peers here have always assumed they weren't. I think maybe your grandparents may have had to ask that question, or your parents. But I think most people my age here just assume they're not because everybody's equal. And then when you scratch that veneer, not very deep, you find what's true. So out of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, I think we had to ask ourselves a couple questions. Am I racist? And then how am I going to live? How am I going to live in the middle of this? And that's where I want to stop on the Arlene story and then say to you for the next few minutes, what are the things that we can learn out of this story? What are the things that we can learn that I think speak to the American experience. The first one, I think, is about identity. So when you ask the question of how am I going to live here, you have to start, you have to take that next step. How do I relate to people, and who do I think they are? Not what do I think they're allowed to do, where can they serve, where can they be successful, who will I let in or out? It's how do I see you? How do I see your humanity? I'd like to put the slide up here about Ubuntu. There is, let me just read this. According to Ubuntu, there exists a common bond between us all, and it's through this bond, through our interaction with our fellow human beings, that we discover our own human qualities. And then the Zulus would say, this is a Zulu word, umuntu, ngumuntu, ngabantu, which means that a person is a person through other persons. We affirm that our humanity when we acknowledge that of others. Bishop Tutu describes it as this, let's go on. The essence of being human, it speaks of the fact that my humanity is caught up and is inextricably bound up in yours. I am human because I belong. It speaks about wholeness. It speaks about compassion. A person with Ubuntu is welcoming, hospitable, warm, and generous, willing to share. Such people are open and available to others, willing to be vulnerable, affirming of others, do not feel threatened that others are able and good, for they have a proper self-assurance that comes from knowing they belong in a greater whole. They know that they are diminished when others are humiliated, diminished when others are oppressed, diminished when others are treated as if they were less than who they are. So this idea of Ubuntu, South African theological, ideological belief, spirituality essentially, that Bishop Tutu is known for promoting. And if you want to read some, Google the theology of Ubuntu. It's just fascinating. But in our questioning, we had to decide, how do I see you as a human? And this was the answer. That I am made more full and more human when I value the humanity in you. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm made more when I can make you into something and I can live among you like you matter. So I think humanity and identity was the first thing, and the first thing we need to address here in America. How do we see each other? Do I see your humanity? And do I value that? Not as permission giving, but as just because of your createdness. The second thing I would say that I learned big time, and I think it applies here, is media. Monitor your media. The 24/7 news cycle is killer. It's killing us. It is killing us. And it was easy in South Africa to say this was an arm of the government, because it was. And it was censored, and there was propaganda, and it was controlled. And I'm not going to say that about American media, but I'm saying don't ever overlook the slant or the angle you're getting sold. Think about Rwanda. I don't know if any of you have spent any time understanding the Rwandan story. But the genocide in Rwanda was linked so heavily to catchphrases used through a radio station. It's a fascinating read. Unbelievable research into how a radio station was used to incite an entire group of people. So watch media usage. I think it's killing us. The third thing I would say is talk. And this is the hard one. Talk to each other. Have a person you can ask hard questions to. And that's not going to be someone who looks like you. You have to have people that you can say, when I say this, is that offensive? Can we just be honest about some things? The reason we don't talk to each other is because we're afraid of offending each other. And we're so afraid of being politically incorrect that we've kind of shut down all conversation. But I think it's a whole lot better when you can sit down with somebody of a different race and say, if I use this phrase, is that problematic? How does that make you feel? What is your experience with that? Better than guessing. Because I tell you now, you have got black friends around you that are going to correct you in the right way. They're going to say the things that you're focusing on are not the things that I'm concerned about. Here's what I'm concerned about. And if we can just be honest and actually talk to each other, I think we're going to solve a lot of problems versus assuming what other people are experiencing. It's been interesting and heartwarming to me and kind of heartbreaking to travel with Jerry Taylor a little bit doing these racial unity leadership summits. I got to sit down in Fresno not very long ago with a mom who's got a son Spencer's age. She told me how she prepares her son, that he doesn't wear a hoodie. And then if he does wear a hoodie, he wears one that doesn't have the kangaroo pouch thing. And if he's got one of those on, don't put your hands in your pockets. And when you go to a certain place, make sure you dress a certain way. And if you're going to be here, just watch your attitude. And she's talking to me about this, and I'm thinking, I've got a son the same age that I've never had to speak one of those words to. Not one time. But unless you were talking to people, you wouldn't know that was somebody else's experience. So talk, have someone you can talk to and that you're willing to be corrected by. Same event. I heard a guy who has an MDiv from here. He's 32, good-looking man, preacher in Southern California, say to me, I wake up every morning and tell myself three things. I'm first a child of God. Secondly, I'm a man. And thirdly, I'm black. Because he said, when I wake up in the morning, if I don't say that to myself, what the world around me is saying to me is that you are a black man who happens to be a Christian. And he said, that has got a story attached to it and a narrative that I'm not living into. And someone else has placed on me. And I'm not going to do that. So unless you're talking to people, you don't know that that's other people's experience. Talk to somebody who is different to you. One of the other things that I think is the biggest thing is acknowledging difficult things. And this is hard. Acknowledge difficult things and be prepared to talk about them. Have you tried to have a conversation about white privilege? Some of you have, because I've seen them on Facebook. It gets ugly really quickly because we're defensive about conversations like that. We've got to talk about difficult things and be okay with it and not be as defensive. Because if you're going to argue that white privilege is not a thing, you do not have enough black friends. The end. Because white privilege is not about resources. It's about access. And that's a bit of a simplification, but that's in Arlene speak. It's never about resources. We can argue all day about who's had the most economically depressed background or who's lived in the worst neighborhood. That's not the discussion. The discussion is who has the voice simply because they show up in their humanity. It's not resource, it's access. Talk about white privilege without being defensive. Let's talk about the melting pot. Another one that we love to use. White people love this one. I don't see race. I don't see color. We're all the same. I believe your intention might be really great if those are your words. But it's the wrong ship. And that ship has sailed for a long time. We need to pull that one back. See race. See people's color. And honor it. We don't have to be one androgynous mass of like sameness. I don't think we do anything by saying, I don't see race. Let's see it and let's value it and honor it and delight in it and celebrate it because it's what makes us beautiful. The other thing I want to say, the other big lesson, talk about difficult things, white privilege, melting pot. Realize because something is not happening to you does not mean it's not happening. Okay? Well, I've never experienced that, so therefore it can't be. Okay. But for real?
Yeah?
Talk to people. See what they're experiencing. The fact that you're not experiencing does not make it so that it's not happening. It just makes it so that you're not experiencing it. So many things. And I'd say, not to counteract the other point, be honest and ask people, what are good words? How do I say this well that it interprets my heart? And the reason that words matter is because sometimes words betray our heart. And you don't know it until you're using them. And then you realize, huh, where'd that come from? I wonder what that's about. Check your words. Okay, so I would say those are the big things. Humanity, identity, media, talk to people, be in real relationship with people that are different to you. And then be prepared to talk about really difficult things. And after all of that, I think we have to realize that the political system is never going to achieve, I don't think, what we're looking for. It's a structure that can't hold up what we're looking for. What we're looking for is something that happens inside community, and it's high touch, and it's visceral, and it's difficult, and it's relational. And we start that daily in interactions. While the political system will never achieve everything we're hoping for, we each have a voice that we can use in interactions daily and in larger scales and in activist scales. I'm not saying don't do anything.
I'm just saying, I think our hope resides in something bigger. Our hope resides, I think, in being honoring our createdness because of God and because of people, and because there's innate value because of who God is and who He's made them to be. And it's inside of that that we find something. But if you have a voice, and you do, use your voice. Use your voice. Let's pray and then we'll leave. I'm not praying my own words. I love that we get to in Churches of Christ, but I also love that we get to use the words of others. And so I'm using the words of others. Walter Brueggemann, At the Dawn. Our first glimpse of reality this day and every day is your fidelity, O God. We're dazzled by the ways you remain constant among us, in season, out of season, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health. You are there in watchfulness as we fall asleep, and you are there in alertness when we awaken, and we are glad. Before the day ends, we will have occasion to flag your absence in indifference, but not now, not at the dawn of the day. Before the day ends, we will think more than once that we need a better deal from you, but not now, not at the dawn of the day. Before the day ends, we will look away from you and relish our own fidelity and our virtue and mercy, but not now, not at the dawn of the day. Now, at the dawn, our eyes are fixed on you in gladness. We ask only that your faithfulness permeate every troubled place we are able to name, that your mercy move against the hurts to make us new, that your steadfastness hold firmly what is too fragile on its own. And we begin the day in joy, in hope, and in deep gladness. You take the feeble night and give us strong days. You take our fatigue and bestow courage. You take our drowsy reluctance and fashion full-blooded zeal. What shall we say? You, only you. You at the hinge. You at the hinge of every day. You and then us. From you in faithfulness for us this day, us in the freedom and courage and energy, and then back to you in trust and gratitude.